Support comes from AstraZeneca, a leader in oncology research with three new FDA-approved medicines in the last 3 years. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. Welcome to Yale Cancer Answers with Drs. Howard Hochster, Anish Chagpar, and Stephen Gore. I'm Bruce Barber. Yale Cancer Answers is our way of providing you with the most up-to-date information on cancer care by welcoming oncologists and specialists who are on the forefront of the battle to fight cancer. This week, it's a conversation about the early detection of esophageal cancer with Dr. Carrie Caldwell and Mr. Joseph Gordon. Dr. Caldwell is an associate clinical professor of internal medicine and digestive diseases at Yale School of Medicine, and Mr. Gordon is a patient. Dr. Hochster is a professor of medicine and medical oncology.
Dr. Caldwell, can you review some of the early warning signs and symptoms of esophageal cancer?
Yes, certainly. Esophageal cancer is, in fact, one of the more devastating GI cancers that we see as gastroenterologists, and unfortunately, sometimes there can be no symptoms at all. But in those who are symptomatic, there's a presentation of dysphagia or so-called difficulty swallowing, principally to solids. There may be a sense of increased gastroesophageal reflux or heartburn, weight loss in advanced cases, and then laboratory findings of iron deficiency anemia. So, but again, the presenting symptoms are chiefly dysphagia to solids, eventually to solids and liquids. And the dysphagia may be referred to in the upper esophagus or the throat, but non-specifically oriented when the culprit lesion may be in the distal esophagus where Barrett's esophagitis originates.
So what you're saying is that if people are having food sticking when it goes down, maybe a sensation of trouble swallowing that persists for a week, a couple weeks, they start to lose weight, they should really get it checked out.
Absolutely. But even earlier than that, with reflux symptoms that have worsened over time. For example, a patient who has heartburn occurring weekly or acid regurgitation weekly, and that it may be increasing in frequency or refractory to therapies such as with proton pump inhibitors, omeprazole, lansoprazole, et cetera. So if symptoms are refractory to treatment, then generally speaking, after vetting by internists, they come to the attention of a gastroenterologist.
So if you have heartburn, you got the pills from your internist, and things are getting worse, not getting better, you better go back and tell them.
That's correct. And even in patients whose symptoms are not getting worse, if they are dependent on proton pump inhibitors, that's the trigger point for an endoscopic evaluation. In other words, we don't want to mask the symptoms without an endoscopic intervention.
Dependent means like for a certain time period, if it doesn't get better?
Absolutely.
How long?
So generally speaking, if the symptoms aren't better within several weeks on proton pump inhibitors, we'll see a patient in our gastroenterology evaluations.
And how common is esophageal cancer?
Esophageal cancer actually is increasing in incidence in the United States. There may be an incidence now of approximately 16 to 18,000. The incidence has probably increased by 300 to 500 fold since the mid-1900s. This varies between genders. There's an increased incidence in men versus women. There's an increased risk in people who are overweight, so obesity is another risk for this as well. Tobacco usage, ethnicity. So we see this, unfortunately, in older white men more than in other populations.
I see. And you kind of earlier said something about if it's in the proximal or high up in the esophagus, you might feel it more in your throat. And then you contrasted that to the distal esophagus, which is more at the bottom of the esophagus where it goes into the stomach. What's the distinction there?
Well, there's a nonspecific locality or localization, I mean. In other words, Barrett's esophagitis is a condition of damage to the distal esophagus, and so that's in the bottom third of the esophagus. And if esophageal cancer has appeared, it's generally in the distal esophagus for adenocarcinoma. That's the kind of cancer, esophageal cancer, that has increased several hundredfold in the last 50 years. So the symptoms may be referred in the upper esophagus, but in fact the tumor itself or disease is in the distal esophagus. Uh-huh. So it's nonspecific.
And you mentioned two things, this Barrett's and something we call GERD, gastroesophageal reflux disease. Can you tell us a little bit more about what those are and their relationship to esophageal cancer?
Yes. So gastroesophageal reflux is a risk for Barrett's esophagitis. And I mentioned that gastroesophageal reflux is the symptom of heartburn. It's also the symptom of a burning or regurgitation sensation in the upper esophagus or mouth. The experience of either one of these or both of these symptoms on a weekly basis is clinically diagnosed or defined as gastroesophageal reflux. Depending on how that's defined, we see this incidence in the population approximately 15% of adults. Endoscopically defined, it's the appearance of damage to the distal esophagus, erosions, inflammation, and so we may see up to 20%, 25% incidence of gastroesophageal reflux. Barrett's esophagitis is a microscopic diagnosis under the microscope, in other words, with distortion of the cells of the inner lining under the esophagus. In other words, the appearance of intestinal epithelium, which are gastric-like cells, whereas normally in the esophagus we see flatter or squamous cells. And so this change in the esophageal mucosa is defined as Barrett's esophagitis when these biopsies are taken above the junction between the stomach and the esophagus.
So due to the effect of this acid coming along all the time, the normal appearance of the esophagus turns into look more like stomach.
Exactly. So we call it gastric-like mucosa or intestinal epithelium. Sometimes this is getting into more details, but the presence of goblet cells in the intestinal epithelia. And that itself is a precursor to esophageal cancer.
So that's like a pre-malignant change that can eventually lead to esophageal cancer.
Yes. And so precisely the annual risk of developing esophageal cancer from Barrett's without dysplasia is approximately 0.1 to 0.5%. Now, when the mucosa actually becomes dysplastic, low-grade or high-grade, then the incidence of cancer is higher, 10 to 15% cumulative risk. And it's the precise reason that we perform endoscopic surveillance on a patient with Barrett's.
Well, that's very interesting. So, Mr. Gordon, can you tell us a little bit about your situation and what happened with you and how you came to be diagnosed?
Okay. When I turned 60, I'm 75 now. When I turned 60, I knew it was time to have a endoscopic exam, a colonoscopy, and I made an appointment with Dr. Caldwell. And before the procedure, he spent quite a long time talking to me about my overall health and other issues, took blood pressure, and discussed in detail what would be involved in this endoscopic exam of my colon. And I was very interested because I'm an engineer, and one of my jobs that I've had in the past was working for a company that made endoscopes. So I knew what they can do and was very interested to hear what he was capable of doing looking at me. So in the process of interviewing me, he said, are there any other issues, health issues? And I said, well, I've got chronic heartburn. I've had a duodenal ulcer as a young teenager, and I've been taking antacids for a long time. And now I take them regularly for heartburn. So he suggested that while I was undergoing this anesthesia process that I should probably have my upper GI system scoped as well. So I said, okay, fine. And he found at that time, when I was roughly 60, that I had Barrett's esophagus and explained with pictures the difference in the cellular structure caused by that, and that he prescribed a different antacid, and the heartburn went completely away. So I felt, you know, cured.
Yeah.
But he pointed out to me that this was a precursor of possible cancer, and I should be screened yearly. And so we basically set it up on a yearly basis for about 12 years. And after that time, he called me into his office after the exam, and there was evidence of a tumor in my esophagus, just as he had predicted could happen. And then he outlined to me what the appropriate next process would be to surgically remove that tumor. And also, which was very gratifying, that he felt that could be that it was diagnosed early enough to eliminate, maybe not need a radiation or chemotherapy, which was the case. I was then transferred under the care of Dr. Anthony Kim at Smilo, who very smooth transition of continuity of care, explaining to me what to expect with the surgery. And it was I spent about 2 weeks or 17 days actually in Smilo, and the surgery was surprisingly without pain. I had not 1 minute of pain in the whole process, and I think I was also well prepared for the fact that I would not be able to eat for a while after the surgery. And it was done laparoscopically, so that there was very little. The size of the opening for my operation, where they completely removed my esophagus, was like an inch
right.
scar,
right.
which basically was very good for my comfort, I'll put it that way.
Right. So so you basically decided to go for a colonoscopy.
Yes.
And you are 60, but I just want to point out to our listeners, the recommendation is to start screening colonoscopy at age 50. But we're glad you went at 60.
I went at 50 also.
Okay, that's good, good. Okay. And then Dr. Caldwell talked to you and he said, well, we should take a look in your esophagus because you were having these ongoing heartburn symptoms.
Yes.
And that's how it came to light. And
yes.
then you had yearly endoscopies.
Yes.
Wow.
It was a life-saving diagnosis by Dr. Caldwell, to whom I am very grateful.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a short break for a medical minute, and please stay tuned to learn more information about esophageal cancer, and we'll hear more from Mr. Gordon on his journey with this disease.
Support comes from AstraZeneca, dedicated to providing innovative treatment options for people living with cancer. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com. The American Cancer Society estimates that over 53,000 new cases of pancreatic cancer will be diagnosed in the United States this year. This number represents about 3% of all cancers in the U.S. and about 7% of all cancer deaths. Clinical trials are currently being offered at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers for the treatment of advanced stage and metastatic pancreatic cancer using chemotherapy and other novel therapies. FOLFIRINOX, a combination of five different chemotherapies, is the latest advance in the treatment of metastatic pancreatic cancer, and research continues at centers around the world looking into targeted therapies and a recently discovered marker, HENT1. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Answers. This is Dr. Howard Hoxter, and my guests, Dr. Carrie Caldwell and Mr. Joseph Gordon, join me tonight to discuss early detection of esophageal cancer. So, Mr. Gordon, you were kind of talking about laparoscopic surgery, and it was painless, and you said you couldn't swallow for a while?
That's correct, right.
How long did that take before you could start eating normally again?
Well, I had a feeding tube right after the surgery. So that's how I received all my nourishment for a while. And then I was transferred to Gaylord Hospital for a rehabilitation for another 2.5 weeks. And in that time, I was treated by speech therapist. In addition to regular exercise and dietitians talking to me about what I could and couldn't eat, and how to go from basically eating nothing but liquids and then gradually progressing to, you know, mashed potatoes, mashed vegetables, and also going with speech therapists into exercises so that I could begin to learn how to swallow without difficulty. Because what they had done is take the stomach and pull it up right up to my throat and then staple it so that the mechanism of swallowing was like a new experience.
I see.
And it was quite a lot of attention paid to the epiglottis, which would make sure that the food would go down my digestive tract rather than into my lungs.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah. And then later that was followed up by Dr. Caldwell with an active, he could probably, I'm sure he can explain it better, but he could actually watch while the epiglottis would function, and it was functioning fine after that point in time. So I feel very fortunate and very, very grateful.
So in the immediate post-op period, you had a lot of training to learn to swallow again or swallow differently?
Yes, that's correct.
And now you're back to eating normal diet?
I feel like I haven't lost any satisfaction from eating. I'm at a better weight. I feel great. I've cut back on my employment. I work only mornings now.
Uh-huh. You're not retired. You're 75
no.
And going strong. That's
well,
great.
Right. Well, I have not going as strong as I did. I have you have to face your mortality. And I thought I have a business that might end up in the dumpster if something were to happen to me. And I trained a young man to take it over, who's done a marvelous job. And in the total treatment, I was out of work for close to 2 months. He ran mm-hmm. the place better than I did. So I'm very lucky to have been able to preserve my business and live a normal life. I'm anxious to kind of tell people who have Barrett's, I have friends that have Barrett's, how important it is to have a yearly endoscopic exam.
Well, thank you, and thank you for sharing your story with us. So, Dr. Caldwell, the Barrett's is one, you know, leads to one kind of esophageal cancer. There are other risk factors for esophageal cancer that our listeners should be aware of, especially for the squamous type. Would you like to discuss that at all?
So, yes. Two main chief kinds of cancer of the esophagus, as you mentioned, squamous cell and adenocarcinoma. And whereas squamous cell was the most common esophageal cancer decades ago, now adenocarcinoma is the leading cause. Squamous cell carcinoma is clearly linked to smoking and alcohol, also toxin ingestions, lye, for instance, intentional or otherwise ingestion, and in certain other parts of the world, the squamous cell cancer is still the leading cause. But in the United States, adenocarcinoma is the leading cause of esophageal cancer. And Barrett's is one of the risk factors. Obesity is as well. There's clearly a link with obesity, high BMIs, several-fold risk over the general population. I mentioned earlier, too, older age, gender as well. We do see a decreased incidence of esophageal cancer, and I want to point this out, that taking proton pump inhibitors is clearly associated with decreased Barrett's, decreased adenocarcinoma, and increased survival. There may be an inverse association with Helicobacter infection, which is a bacterium that invades the gastric mucosa, so-called the lining of the stomach. And we do see in some cases of Helicobacter gastritis, particularly throughout the stomach, a decreased incidence of Barrett's.
Some people may be aware of that by the name of H. pylori.
H. pylori.
Yeah.
Yes. One of the things I wanted to mention is the follow-up and management of such a patient with Barrett's, and we did hear that yearly endoscopic surveillance is what led to this early diagnosis, but lest the listeners believe that that is the absolute recommendation of all gastroenterologists. So generally speaking, now we suggest endoscopic surveillance every 2 to 3 years for Barrett's. It was in Mr. Gordon's case that I chose to do yearly endoscopic surveillance because 1 year he did have what's called low-grade dysplasia in a few of the biopsies. And what I mean by dysplasia, think of it as disordered mucosa. And dysplasia is a precursor of cancer or early cancer, if you will. So low-grade dysplasia warrants close follow-up, and we did that within 6 months and then yearly afterwards and didn't see any further dysplasia. Dysplasia, again, is an indicator for more frequent endoscopic surveillance, which then led to his diagnosis, fortunately, early. And I'll say that because esophageal cancer, unfortunately, at the time of diagnosis, is a limited disease that is confined to the esophagus in only 25% of patients. So Mr. Gordon was one of the fortunate ones who had the disease confined to the esophagus. By tumor criteria, he was so-called T1A and, T1B. And it was for that reason, plus the fact that his Barrett's esophagitis was defined as long segment, in other words, longer than 3 centimeters in his esophagus, that we felt the surgical outcome was the best. There are other options, for example, with somebody who has a T1A lesion and short segment Barrett's esophagus, who might be better suited to endoscopic mucosal resection, or EMR, and this is done by some of our endoscopic ultrasound colleagues at Yale.
So just want to emphasize that in Mr. Gordon's case, because of the amount of the esophagus, the length, he needed surgery, but some people with smaller areas of involvement can have surgery done endoscopically. They don't need to have major surgery. It can be done like the same way that they have the regular endoscopic look. See, they can also resect it.
That's exactly right. And generally speaking, endoscopic therapy is easily tolerated. There are some periprocedure risks of stricture, bleeding, or rarely perforation, meaning penetration through the wall of the esophagus. And then there's even a syndrome of epithelial or submucosal disease and, or hidden Barrett's and dysplasia. In other words, because of treatment with another form of endoscopic therapy, such as radiofrequency ablation, whereby the dysplastic tissue could be possibly covered up by scar tissue. And that happens in about 5% of patients treated with radiofrequency ablation or RFA.
So one of the real keys or key messages is that if you go for surveillance and they find this early and it's relatively confined, you might not even need surgery. It can be treated and cured without a big surgery with just this endoscopic procedure.
That's right.
That's very encouraging news today for our patients. And I guess because of the risks you talk about, including perforation, which is basically a hole in the esophagus, people should be sure to go to physicians who are well experienced with these endoscopic techniques.
That's correct. So the long-term management of such a patient with Barrett's and by whom and where, generally speaking, GERD and Barrett's is a common diagnosis and is managed by the majority of gastroenterologists. And the frequency of surveillance is really contingent on what's the underlying histology, as I mentioned earlier, low-grade dysplasia or higher. When it comes to the point of possibly needing endoscopic mucosal resection or EMR or the other alternative RFA, then we'll use the endoscopic experience of people who use endoscopic ultrasound and we'll refer patients appropriately for that procedure when it is applicable to people like Mr. Gordon. In his case, again, we had him see an endoscopic ultrasonographer, not for treatment, but really for diagnosis. So I wanted to make that point that in the workup of a patient who has a newly found nodule that by biopsy shows esophageal cancer, we will always use endoscopic ultrasound as a determinant of extent of disease. The endoscopic ultrasound probe on the end of the endoscope allows visualization within the walls of the esophagus to find out how far that tumor has progressed.
So everybody, I think, is somewhat familiar with ultrasound from women who are pregnant. The endoscope people can actually have a little scope with that kind of device on it, and they can see how big the tumor is and how deep it goes into the wall of the esophagus. That's kind of an important part of the staging.
That's absolutely correct.
So for the people who are smokers and drinkers and are worried about this, we recently had a discussion on Yale Cancer Answers about the lung cancer screening program with CAT scans. What is the recommendation for screening for esophageal cancer?
So for esophageal cancer, once it's diagnosed, in addition to the EUS, the endoscopic ultrasound, we also suggest a CAT scan or PET scan to make sure there's localized disease.
And pre that screening, should people be talking to their doctors about this, going for endoscopies?
Absolutely. If they're having symptoms of chronic GERD that's getting worse or is refractory to treatment of the so-called PPIs, proton pump inhibitors.
Dr. Kerry Caldwell is an associate clinical professor of internal medicine and digestive diseases at Yale School of Medicine, and Dr. Joseph Gordon is a patient. If you have questions, the address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and past editions of the program are available in audio and written form at yalecancercenter.org. I'm Bruce Barber, reminding you to tune in each week to learn more about the fight against cancer here on WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.